Thanks, Robert. And for everyone's benefit, I'm Eric Gustafson with Marsh & McLennan Companies. I'm the head of our government relations effort. And for those of you that don't know about Marsh & McLennan Companies, we're a leading global consultant on risk and insurance solutions. We have a variety of brand names you may have heard of: Marsh, Guy Carpenter, Mercer, and Oliver Wyman. And for this exercise, I have been working with colleagues both in Marsh and in Guy Carpenter to renew a study that Marsh has produced over the past few years over the life of TRIA to help characterize the nature of the emerging U.S. market for terrorism risk insurance. And we are set to release an updated version of this study in late April, perhaps April 30th. The event is coming together. We're working with some of the folks that are here to finalize that and pull together something on Capitol Hill where we can start the fact-based education of our policymakers so that they can make a decision about how TRIA or its successors move forward. When I agreed to actually participate in this, I thought, oh, great, I'll have slides and we can just run through it and the whole presentation will build itself. But the slides are not yet final, and so therefore they're not public, so I'll just walk you through some of our initial findings, understanding that the full study will be released later this month. So I think before I get into that, though, I think it's important to acknowledge that TRIA is generally a program that has worked dramatically well. It is while understanding that it has not been fully tested, it has served its intended purpose of allowing the American economy to work, for business enterprises to cover their risks, and for them to engage in activities that raise tax revenue, provide jobs, and generally allow the U.S. economy to grow. And so for that, I think that Robert and Tom deserve a tremendous amount of credit, because if you were to wander around the streets of Houston or other cities and ask what is sort of an essential program that most people don't take into consideration that has allowed America to recover from the acts of 9/11, most people would not say TRIA, but it is, in fact, an essential ingredient to America's growth and security. And it was conceived in a very difficult time, conceived of as a temporary program in hopes, perhaps optimistically, that the terrorism risk would recede. But, in fact, it is something that is persistent, that our country and, in fact, the world continues to grapple with. And so as the program has evolved, it has certainly taken into consideration that this risk is persistent, but has requested more of the private sector, that it do more and that the taxpayer bear less of the potential burden. And over that time, as our survey has demonstrated, yes, the private sector has been asked to do more, but the availability is still there. The cost is reasonable relative to other risks that are available in the market. And so it has succeeded. As a program, it has provided cover at an affordable price. And so what we see generally in this survey that will be released later this month, we've surveyed about 2,600 firms from across the country, is that take-up rates are more or less flat at around 62%. So it's a substantial number of business enterprises that feel they need coverage have purchased it already. Regardless of the total insured value, the take-up rates are high. Not surprisingly, the larger the business enterprise, the greater the take-up rate, reaching into the 70s as a percent. Generally speaking, across industry sector, take-up rates are also consistent and have been. We have noticed that energy and retail have fallen off a bit. But it's important to note that our sample of the energy sector was a bit light, and so it may just be that it was we don't have good data to draw the conclusion that the energy sector is buying less terrorism coverage. Regionally speaking, we've looked at this based on our survey of these 2,600 companies and where they kind of report in. We've characterized them into that area, so a company that reports to our our New York City office would be characterized as reporting in the Northeast region, obviously, but that company may have insured risks across the map. For that reason, we think the Northeast region has the highest take-up rates. In the mid-70s, the next region highest is the South, followed by the Midwest, and finally the West has the lowest take-up rates, but still north of 55%. The cost of the coverage as a percent of general property coverage has been, again, relatively flat. It's only moved about a point or two. This over the last three surveys that we have done over the life of TRIA. And so we find that the cost is, by total insured value is flat. It is generally higher for smaller business enterprises. Those that are less than $100 million have insured rates of about $50 per million of coverage. It drops substantially for firms that are above a billion. And the full detail on that is in the report. When it was released, you can have a look at that. The general speaking, cost by industry sector, not surprisingly, constructions, utility are quite high. Real estate is relatively high, but still not on an affordable basis. Something that surprised us this time around is that the cost for media companies has been ticking up a bit. I don't know that it's necessarily newsworthy, but the idea that media companies are buying terrorism coverage and it's costing a tiny bit more was something that stood out. Those are sort of the highlights of the study. I could go on. It proves to be a bit boring, frankly, to go through it stat by stat. And I would be pleased to answer questions. I do have a draft copy with me, so if anybody has a specific question later in the Q&A, I could turn to that page and kind of read off what we have. As we look at the TRIA program or its iterations on a global basis, we find that most developed countries, in fact, all of the significant G8 players and G20 players, have a terrorism risk insurance program of one sort or another. Looking at the UK, the Pool Re program, Spain, Germany, I could go through those in detail as well. One notable item is that they all involve some level of government backing, if not being sort of an outright government program. They have mandatory pools in certain cases. So the government does play a role on a global basis. Government plays a role on some basis on a globally speaking with regard to terrorism risk. And finally, I think the view of the company is that while the program was designed, TRIA designed to be temporary, it's designed to ensure a risk that has transformed the architecture of the American economy. The idea of a core business district is something that evolved over hundreds of years and has been kind of put on its ear by a threat that, in a very unpredictable way, challenges that exact item. And it's not even just the core business district. It's sort of an identifiable infrastructure asset, a pipeline, a power plant, other forms of infrastructure. And so while it is of particular interest to the urban core on the Northeast, any small town that is placed near a pipeline or other kinds of infrastructure along those lines bears a risk. The businesses and the individuals that live there, the workers' comp that is provided also bears a risk. And so as the economy, the U.S. economy, grapples with this challenge to our established business architecture and really the architecture of economies globally, the insurance industry has to challenge the way in which it has traditionally understood risks. It's not something that's going to play out over even 10 years. It's going to take longer. Even the safety, those of us who live in Washington, D.C., know that it has taken them about 10 or 15 years to really put in all the bollards that are needed on all the various buildings, and they're still working through those details. To expect that the insurance sector is going to be able to stand on its own against a really sort of an unknowable risk is, I don't think, realistic. And so the TRIA program needs to be extended in one form or another. We look forward to using the facts of our survey to educate policymakers and engage with our colleagues to understand what concerns may the other side may have, and demonstrate why the program needs to move forward. So with that, I'll turn it over to Tom and look forward to questions. Thank you.
Thanks. I'm Tom Glassick. I'm the General Counsel of the D.C. Department of Insurance, Securities, and Banking. And after doing this for many years with Robert and with Baird and Eric, I need to go get a new job to have something new to say. So it's great. I get to speak to the group from the state regulatory perspective. And I guess unfortunately, none of them are here today. But this has been a strong, healthy thing that the NAIC has done in coordination with the federal government, starting right after 9/11. Terry Vaughn led the initiatives at that point, interacting with, helping states be coordinated in their response to a lot of insurance entities not being comfortable writing the cover immediately, dealing with exclusions, how we're going to deal with exclusions on a state-by-state, but also in a supervised, in a coordinated manner, keeping states informed so that the market keeps moving forward. At the same time, Terry and the NAIC actively worked with the Congress as things were being developed because there was no TRIA office because there wasn't a TRIA yet. So how we're going to get prepared for the initial rollout of TRIA, and with also those of us who were there throughout the process, dealing with what lines were going to be covered, how this was going to be dealt with. We had wonderful leadership from Terry, from the NAIC, getting notice forms prepared, getting information out both to state regulators and then through state regulators and through the TRIA program to the purchasers of commercial insurance that would or wouldn't include terrorism risk. More illustriously, as Robert alluded, the initiative was led in a large part in 2007 by Mike McCraith. Mike McCraith is now head of the Federal Insurance Office, so I actually actively teased him that rather than doing my own presentation, I was going to read his testimony from 2007, and that was going to be my presentation. He asked that I please not do that because he is in a new position, and the Treasury Department, while where the TRIA program is housed on from an administrative perspective, is also part of a political process, obviously started in 2001, 2002 under the Bush administration, was reauthorized twice under the Bush administration. So we actually don't have an Obama administration official word on this. And Mike, I know, will be working over the summer and getting things prepared so that his office can engage with the Congress, and the TRIA office does still independently exist with FIO. But so from the state regulator's perspective, what I wanted to do, just yesterday, the C committee reinstituted or recreated the Terrorism Insurance Implementation Working Group. It's got seven states and District of Columbia included. Many of the places that you would expect, New York, Florida, Texas, but Oklahoma for a very obvious reason. And we are, to the extent to which there are regulators in the room, if your state is interested, if you want to reach out and people are interested in being involved in the working group as we get moving, both educating states and educating Congress again, please let me or Eric know. And I think pretty much open membership. We're going to need the help, and I know that the NAIC, when we do the fly-in this year, I think TRIA is going to start getting to members of Congress, and that's a big portion of what the NAIC has been doing throughout this entire process. And it's actually a nice, if we want to be insurance nerds and step back, it's one of the nice pre-FIO examples of state-federal interaction that has really benefited everyone who's interacted with the program. The working group has three charges. One of them is to coordinate the NAIC efforts, just keeping everyone informed, but also getting feedback from state regulators as things move forward. Like Robert said, we're likely going to see a time period next summer where TRIA will not have been reauthorized by Congress. TRIA might not have even been voted on by anyone in Congress by then, but people need to plan ahead for 2015. So you'll see conditional exclusions coming back in. The question will be, and we'll go ahead and coordinate a bunch of states last time around were okay with exclusions for terrorism risks if TRIA was not if TREE was not reauthorized, so you'll start getting questions about, and I want to say only 28 states actually did something affirmatively, we have to check that, only did something affirmatively regarding the exclusions the first time around in 2002. So just to make sure that states are as coordinated as we can be. Policyholder disclosure forms that the NAIC created and promulgated will probably look quite the same unless the program itself changes. And the second of the big charges for the working group is to coordinate with, well, the working group says coordinate with the Treasury Department, but I think I said it's going to probably coordinate with the FIO office. The FIO office looks to be taking the lead along with the Terrorism Risk Insurance Program is still a separate thing within Treasury, but interacts with the FIO office. And we're working with them quite regularly, getting ready for reauthorization on from a technical point of view, what sorts of things could be considered, making sure we get answers. They're going to get a lot of questions, both from the administration perspective, and they'll start getting questions from Congress. So we look forward to staying actively involved and helping in that process. There's also a more formal process. The President's Working Group on Economic... But the President's Working Group, there we go. The President's Working Group has been charged and is charging the TREA legislation to do regular reports on the terrorism marketplace. The first was in 2006, then there was one in 2010, came out at the end of the year, and there's another one due in 2013. You know, we expect that you'll see a notice from the TRIP office sometime this summer, and they'll be putting out a report at the end of the year. Obviously, the NAIC will want to be actively involved in responding to the request for information and encouraging everyone else to do that. There was a great deal of input into the 2010 report, and I think we certainly hope to see the same sorts of things. The bad part about the 2013 report requirement is it's another excuse Congress can use to not do anything until after the report comes out. So it's good and bad. And then obviously the working group looks forward to post-reauthorization, working with the TREA office, working with the FIO to make sure that if there are any changes to the program that those changes are clearly communicated and also understood on the flip side of what, you know, were the program to change, what impacts could we see in the market, what sorts of things do we need to plan for. Baird brought up a great example. The current legislation requires recruitment by 2017. Well, when in 2007, that was a long time to recruit. If we had an event now, it would be a significantly more dramatic attempt, and Congress probably actually have to step in. So the working group will stay involved with the TREA office, with the President's working group, and making sure as much information can come from the states, from the marketplace, so that Congress has some understanding that, you know, this is a very healthy program, it is a very cheap program for the United States, and it has provided a significant support in both economic development and this is a continuation of the growth that we started to see over the last several years. What I think is fun is my hometown, Washington, D.C., when TREA was up the first time around, wasn't a whole lot of construction. There was building, but not a whole lot of construction. Right now, we have 58 cranes up in the District of Columbia. So when I was asking our administration whether or not they wanted me to be involved in this, and I explained that all those cranes have to stop working after the end of 2014 if there's not terrorism insurance, the mayor's office decided that it was important for us to be involved. So it's very interesting. And I also want to remind states, I mean, you know, the extent to which you're not a state with a large metropolitan area that would be one of the places where I'm sure, Eric, even though terrorism insurance is pretty much regularly available and easily got, in large urban areas, strong concentration, there is a little bit of lack of availability of the size limits people are looking for. But this is not a large city issue. This is a national issue, and I thank Robert for giving me this one video, this one aid to certainly make that point. So we're certainly interested in states who might not necessarily be focusing on a Manhattan risk, but can't forget the fact that this is a significant portion of their own economic development. And building projects without terrorism cover, if it's a significant building project, we saw both in 2007 and 2002, folks are just not interested in starting projects. So it doesn't matter what size your state is. The third part of the charge is, it was something that Director McGrath, when he was Director McGrath and testified in the Senate, brought up, and it's something that the NAIC is, you know, certainly most skilled at doing, is if Congress is interested in, if the national debate is interested in different structures, different approaches for a long-term approach. I mean, we could take temporary out of the TRIA bill and fix everything forever, but I don't think that's going to happen. So we need to be open to, and certainly with the anxiety some House members have with even reauthorizing TRIA at all, something we haven't really seen in a while, the idea that there might be other solutions or that there might be other things added to TRIA that would lessen the government involvement and perhaps, you know, increase the private participation, the private level comfort to participate. Although I personally, I think the working group will get there and everyone on this panel can't envision a circumstance where TRIA couldn't or would not exist going forward. It's something maybe we're far away from Congress and we should not be dreaming, but it's very hard to picture a time period in the near future where a fully private solution would be available. So I do encourage anyone who's interested. I mean, everyone keeps asking me, what does the NAIC think? And I literally just pulled out Mike McRae's testimony from 2007 and started reading. So the NAIC strongly supports the program's existence, not as a policy decision, but as a participant in the marketplace and for the continuity of market-based practices that we can rely on over time. So the NAIC doesn't have an opinion as to how long reauthorization would be, but those of us who follow the flood insurance program, three-day reauthorization, three-day unauthorization process, know that those sorts of uncertainties in a federal program are certainly not helpful. So the NAIC supports a long, consistent, reliable approach, and I will yield to Mike, and we'll be...
Great. Thank you, Tom. And now, it would be bad if the actuary can't pass the technology test. So, let's see. We got that. Okay. The, you know, I think Eric had described me as the cleanup hitter initially, and I have a son. One of my sons is a runner. He's a good little runner. And I feel like I'm the anchor man now. And you know, he participates on the, you know, the four-man distance medley relay team or whatever. And the role of the anchor is, if you're ahead, don't give up the lead. Keep ahead, right? If you're behind, there's a lot of ground that you need to take to get you into the lead. And in following, you know, the four presenters before me, you know, we're in a position of ahead. So my role here is not to lose the lead. And I've got 17 slides, and what I found is I don't need to go through 17 slides because of what the prior panelists had done. So I guess what I'd like to cover is, one, from an actuarial perspective, I'm Vice President of the American Academy of Actuaries. You have our disclaimer. We're a very large organization. And I think when I look at terrorism as a risk, and as I heard, I'll say the other four panelists, and when you think of we as insurers and we as actuaries, what we like to do, we like predictable things. Right, we like to be able to project loss costs. We like frequency. We like severity. You know, when you look at the gamut of insurable risks, we love life insurance. We love personal auto insurance because you have a lot of data. You have a lot of risks that you can estimate the, you know, in a given cohort of the population, how many people will live the next year or 2 years or 3 years before that. When you have a cohort information of drivers in a certain region, you have a decent predictability of maybe their tendencies in terms of how they drive, what some of the key rating variables are. And, you know, when you move to the other side of the gamut in terms of what actuaries like to use to project loss cost and insurability, you have things like hurricane insurance, you have things like catastrophe, earthquake insurance, maybe even a little bit on the flood side. And when you look at terrorism, terrorism really falls even beyond the scope of things like earthquake insurance. So one, the frequency is obviously very small. What you'll see in our slides a little bit later is that there have been, over the last 6 or 8 years, there's been about 16 events. The exposure is significant. That is the statement stating the obvious, as you've heard. And we've got ranges, you know, from 9/11, what number do you want to pick, $40 billion in today's dollars? To the CNBR attack on New York City, that is, I think we heard $100 billion, well above $100 billion. There are estimates out there that put it, you know, well above half a trillion, bordering three quarters of a trillion dollars. So the annual cost, when you look at terrorism, you know, it varies significantly depending upon whether attack occurs or not. So when you look at the budgeting process, are we looking at the expected value, or are we looking at the two extremes? Nothing happens, you know, as we heard earlier. When nothing happens, the cost is relatively small. When something happens, it's going to be big, and the cost will be very significant. I would like to cover a little bit on the current perspective private market for terrorism coverage. The market has been stable. We heard our friends at Marsh talk about this, and the study, our data has some of this information from the prior Marsh study, looking very forward to the new results coming out. The market has been stable. What we've seen is the cost is cents on the dollar when you look at relative to TIV, and it's percentage points relative to property premium cost. And then we will not cover how terrorism, how TRIP works, because I think we've covered that already. And then the importance of a timely terrorism, basically a renewal process. And really the impact of non-renewal on industry capacity here is significant. So terrorism, very much unlike most insurable risks. And when I think of this, we said it's difficult to measure the frequency. We think at times we can measure the frequency of hurricane losses. We think at times we can measure the frequency of earthquake losses, and terrorism is even further off the gamut of that. Obviously, the severity is significant depending upon the location. So with this difficulty in measuring risk, there's obviously a difficulty in pricing for it. And what happens in our industry when we have such uncertainty? Right? I'm the actuary. I have been told for the, you know, I spent 30 years as a practicing actuary. And, you know, when you guys have a large uncertainty, what do? You throw, you know, a provision for uncertainty on it. You jack up your prices, or you throw capital against these risks. And as we get into that, you know, the randomness of these losses, you know, the most insurable risks occur at random times in random locations. Personal auto, life insurance risks are pretty good. Terrorism losses are just the opposite. And because we've had so few attacks, you know, which is a good thing, obviously, we have a really lack of available data on which to base our estimates of frequency losses. We've got a population of Americans for mortality risk. We've got a population of drivers for personal auto risk. We don't have a population of terrorist attacks. And the last part of this is that the terrorist attacks are intrinsically focused on maximizing the financial, the psychological impact. So they're unlikely to be geographically dispersed, which will cause adverse selection. And when you think about the insurance industry and what we do at times, when you think about the insurability of risk, a lot of times we like to be able to influence either the frequency of loss or the severity of loss. Whether you're a risk control or risk manager for a large corporation, whether you're an underwriter for an insurer, whether you're an actuary in that area, what you like to do is be able to influence the frequency or the severity of risk and decrease it. So for personal auto, you have many insurers out there putting black boxes in cars to understand your driving habits. If you're a good driver, we'll give you credits. Right? If you are accident-free, we'll institute, you know, a change in your deductible. And if you think of the flood insurance program, and as I look at the flood insurance program, I have a place at the Jersey Shore. And in New Jersey, there is this line. Right? There's this line that you're above the line, you had devastation. And there's another line a little further south. If you were below the line, you had nothing. And I was in between those two lines. But when I looked at, I had a foot and a half of water at my place at the shore, and I had thousands of dollars worth of damage. Single digit thousands of dollars worth of damage. Why? Because of the loss control efforts by the NFIP that, you know, my house was built after 1977 that basically forced me to not have living space below 12 feet above sea level. So while we had lots of water in space that was not in a livable area, building codes, provisions in insurance coverage enabled us to have less losses. So think about that as we think about the insurity. Terrorism just does not have these characteristics that we like. There's this part of us, and I've seen this, I spent part of my career working with our catastrophe underwriting group, and there's this tendency to think of the terrorist threat has abated, but the risk has persisted. And throughout our history of the insurance industry and throughout the last 20 years, we had this perception that hurricanes had abated. And then in 1992, we had Hurricane Andrew. Earthquakes had abated. And in 1994, we had Northridge. And we got into this sense of complacency. We saw it again in 2004, 2005 with some very active hurricane seasons. 2010, 2011, the year of the international earthquakes, 2012, you know, the basically this tendency for us to get complacent about storms hitting the Northeast, and then we had Sandy. So, you know, the risk has not abated. The risk certainly persists, and the magnitude is big, as you can see there. When we look at the breadth of the exposure, as I said earlier, there were 16 attacks in the last 4 or 5 years. We have a lot of reasons to be concerned. There's unrest in the Middle East. Basically, in July of 2012, one of our friends at the modeling agencies, RMS, you know, increased homegrown terrorist threat of conventional attacks by individual operatives. We have threats to our transit system. We have the maritime piracy terrorism that we've been seeing lately. The threat is there. So what does that say about the current market right now? Well, the market has been stable, which is a nice thing. And the market has been stable for lots of reasons. When you look at basically the report by the GAO in 2008, that basically terrorism is generally available. We heard our friends from Marsh talk about take-up rates around 60 to 70%. You know, some of there are certain areas where high-value properties in densely built cities, it's been difficult to get. Some of those owners have sought other solutions. When you look at the report for the President's Working Group, right, the availability and the affordability has increased since 2006 because the insurers have increased their capital. Market capacity has increased. Capacity is still constrained in certain high-risk geographical locations and properties. But when we look at why we've had these improvements, part of it has been improvements in modeling. Part of it has been in improvements in the way we manage aggregate loss exposure. The industry in 2004, 2005, we had a wake-up call. Four storms hitting Florida, Katrina, Rita, Wilma in 2005. Rating agencies, regulators, really asking for more disclosure. Wall Street asking for more disclosure on our CAT aggregate loss exposure. So we've gotten better at modeling. Now, it doesn't stop us from every time there's an event, we say, why did the models get it wrong? So, again, there's that false sense of complacency that as we have made significant improvements in our modeling and our capabilities, but that doesn't mean it's right. A model is a is better at pointing you in a certain direction. We've had new market entrants that have increased competition. We have a better understanding of aggregate risk, and because of this, this increased capacity has certainly lowered prices. As we said earlier, the take-up rates are about 60%. Market participants still uncertain about the ability to protect. Again, the models are difficult. When we look at some of the factors that are out there, we've got uncertainty that influences the policyholder's perception of risk and their purchasing decisions, as well as the way the insurers and the reinsurers allocate their capacity. I spent a great deal of time having those discussions about how we allocate our CAT capacity. And when we look at this, we think that capacity will continue to limit private market expansion. Basically, the CNBR, as we heard earlier, the number is big. The number is vast, and it's almost uninsurable. Okay, I don't need to discuss how TRIP works because we've heard of that. So why is it important for a timely TRIP renewal? Because without the backstop, without the ability of the federal government to provide a backstop for terrorism, we will have these persistent uncertainties regarding potential attacks that will make it very likely that premiums will increase, they'll become expensive, they'll become volatile, there will be knock-on effects in terms of capital requirements, provisions for uncertainty, or just pure uninsurability. The availability of the coverage will be greatly reduced, particularly after a next event. There's this other part, and we heard it a few times already, that if and when the next event occurs, you know, the federal government is likely to step in and cover some of these commercial losses. So it's appropriate that if we're going to have this backstop to losses, that we get basically some, we've got the ability to recover some of those losses from the federal government, from the insurers. I think we heard it capped at 133%. Without this, we would expect the following. Some coverages, workers' comp, which is unlimited in nature, would basically become much riskier for insurers. I think of 9/11. I think of a friend of mine who was an underwriter looking at a risk from 9/11, and one of the major companies, they did not provide the workers' compensation coverage for that risk. Had his company done that, they would have wiped out half of their capital on 9/11 alone. So again, there's a lot of risk in there. So the required coverage will become more expensive. It will be less available. The insurers will need to limit their terrorism risk exposure. They'd have no choice but to avoid the exposure because of either reduce the number of insureds which the insurer provides coverage to, or find another way to control, whether through reinsurance or some other type of loss control mechanism. And if no exclusions exist for the riskiest coverage, states could expose insurers to very, very large losses, ultimately reduce availability for non-terrorism coverage and financial solvency of affected insurers. And what we've seen, the NAIC now, we're now talking about a cat charge in the RBC formulas. And now as we think about the terrorism exposure, you know, that just creates another charge that would be out there in the RBC. You know, there's an estimated cost that if TRIP expires that would happen. You know, conventional attack, you think of September 11th, $32.5 billion in 2001 dollars, $40 billion in today's dollars. You know, the range, as we said, is very wide, $27 billion to $778 billion. That range is as wide as Montana. The private primary reinsurance capacity likely to be insufficient to fill the gap that would be created. And then the existing market could be disrupted should TRIP be permitted to expire. Even if it's eventually reauthorized, our experience with the NFIP, you know, repeated expirations, reauthorizations, has been instructive. We have certainly learned every time we've had these discussions. I just want to make sure I don't want to duplicate things I've said already or has been said already. What I'd like to do to really conclude so we can get to the Q&A, to the extent that coverage for conventional terrorism risk is available and affordable, it's because of the existence. It's attributable to the existence of TRIP. The structure of the program has encouraged development for reinsurance for layers of risk that insurers must bear themselves, whether they be the deductible amounts, copays. This allows primary insurers to provide coverage. And without TRIP, the insurers would be far less likely to offer terrorism risk insurance. So with that, I'll stop and open it up for Q&A. Okay. Back to you, Eric.